Good evening, everybody. David Deering here. Donald Davidson right in front of me. This is the Talk of Gasoline Alley, and thank you guys for joining us this evening. Donald, good to see you once again.
Hi, David.
And we got a call yesterday, Donald, right at the end of the show. Greg from Indy called in, and Greg, we wanted to wait. Donald wanted to wait as well. You had a question for Donald. Donald, we'll get to it. Greg, could you refresh us what the question was?
Absolutely. And first of all, let me say, this is so cool. I've tried to get in to talk to Donald for years and have never been able to get through. And now I'm here on back-to-back nights. Go see. My question was, well, my dad had a band locally. Mm-hmm. And one of the places he played was the Mates White Front, which is just a little east of the track on 16th.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And he actually got to know a lot of the drivers, and two of the drivers in particular that he, from what he told me, became fairly good friends with were Pat O'Connor and Bob Swikert.
Uh-huh.
And he got tickets for the 58 race from Mates. And he and my mom went, and of course, Pat O'Connor lost his life in that race.
Yeah.
And he didn't go back until he took me to my first race in 1969. So mm-hmm. I wanted to hear what you knew about Mates. And then there's another thing, since I've got you, I'll probably never talk to you again. I had one more question. My nephew recently got married in Noblesville at a place called the Milltop. And when I went in there, there was a plaque that said that the 1911 winner, the Marmon Wasp, was built in that building. Do you know anything about that?
Okay. I don't know where that one came from, because the Marmon Wasp was built at Kentucky and Morris.
That's interesting.
So I think somebody else told me about it. Where is that place?
It's in Noblesville.
Yeah, I don't know where that came from.
It's a brick building.
Well, the Marmon factory was at Kentucky and Morris, and that's where the Marmon Wasp was built. In one corner of the engineering department at Nordyke and Marmon was the company. So I don't know where that one came from. But about the White Front, yes, I'm so glad you called back. And I hated to we have this long-standing, it's just Murphy's Law that when you say, okay, we've got one more minute or two more minutes, we can just sneak in a quick one, and it's always something that's
the law of radio,
involved.
Donald.
So I'm so happy you called back. Anyway, the White Front, actually the original White Front was a different building further to the west, right very close to the railroad track. So if you are going west on 16th and you go underneath the underpass, the railway underpass, you've just gone by up on top of the hill is the original White Front. I can't think what it's called now, but it's not Mike's that's on the corner. That's another bar. But anyway, that where that underpass is, that used to be a level crossing. And I think the original White Front opened, I'm thinking it was like 1948 or so. But when the word came along in probably 1952, because the job was completed in 53, Mike Mates told me this, and actually had some photographs that I wish I'd paid more attention to, that I went to visit him at his house, and he had all these photographs. And he said, we got the word that they were going to close 16th Street around us and then gouge out the tunnels underneath the railroad track so that the trains would keep running. And so there was a way to come around and come in the back way to get to us. And he said, I thought that's going to kill our business. And so he said, we moved down the street. So what I've never known was the building now, which is Club Venus, that became
exactly
the White Front. And I think it opened in 53, I think, 53, 54 sometime. And so I don't know if that building pre-existed or if Mike Mates had it put up. I've never known that. But anyway, when I showed up in 1964, and it was just here for the 3 weeks. I was taken there, a fellow named Kenny Moran, who was a crew member, but of the Moran Electric Company. And he said, you got to go to the White Front. And I didn't know what the heck he was talking about. And he took me down there. And it was louder than the devil. And I remember Bud Tinkelstead was in there. And so I'm not sure if I may have gone back one or two times in 64, but I do know that I was in there that one time. And then when I came back in 1965 to stay, I learned very, very quickly that Thursday night was movie night at the White Front. And so a fellow would get a 16-millimeter projector, and he would rent some films, normally probably 3 to 4 films, I suppose. And around 6:30, they'd start showing racing movies. And they would stop about 8:30 because the bands would start at 9 and they needed a little change over time. So that was the tradition. Every Thursday night, I wasn't driving yet, and I'd have somebody, Dick Jordan, who's now vice president at USAC, I became friends with very early, and he would drop me off. He'd either stay with me or he'd drop me off because he had a date or something. And so I would stay in the White Front and watch the movies. But the great thing was the participants that came in. It was pretty much of a sprint car type crowd, but Ronnie Duman, Chuck Rohde, Bobby Grimm, some of them would just nurse a drink. Others, you know, got into it a little bit more. But Herdebees and Wally Muskowski, A.J. Watson, they were all regulars. Carl Williams, Gary Congdon. Judd Larson occasionally, Greg Weld occasionally, although Greg only drank Coke. And then I remember one night in the winter, well, Roger McCluskey was another, so let me finish this other bit about running the movies. They would be, 500 films, but occasionally they'd have like the Southern 500 or something. But it was so much fun to watch those things because as it was going on, people around me were identifying people that were in the shot that were not, you know, a part of the story necessarily, but they'd say, oh, they're so-and-so. And then sometimes there would be a huge cheer go up, and especially if somebody in the audience, they're watching the film, and if it was a race where they spun out, and then everybody in the place would cheer, and the guy would look embarrassed, and there'd be a lot of yelling back and forth, and it was just really great, great fun. And so there would be a lot of the drivers that came back that would spend the summer, or the spring and summer, in the area. They'd live in the area and go Thursday nights. And then about the end of September, then they would all go home. So it was a lot fewer racers. But I remember that I would go in there on a Saturday night. And then there would be people that would be visiting in town. I just remember this, whatever the event was, it was like the dead of winter. And every time the door would open, we'd all turn around to see who was coming in. And I remember Art Pollard and Al Unser, a very young Al Unser. This, I'm talking 66, 67. And Al Unser and Art Pollard came in. They'd given a talk together, and they were wearing gray suits, white shirts, and red ties. And, young Al Unser was a good-looking guy, jet black hair, wavy black hair. And I just remember those two just looked like movie stars coming in. But I spent a lot of time with Billy DeVore and Tinkelstead and the old riding mechanics that were still around. And I learned a lot of stuff. People told me stories in there. And it started to go away around 1970. It became a biker bar. And then it took on several other profiles. And it's been a gentleman's club for quite a while. So it's Club Venus now. But I go by there a lot. And I've got a lot of happy memories of the people that I spent time with. That's where I met Leroy Yarborough, was in the White Front. He was in there with Bill Cheeseburg. I remember Sonny H, Sam Sessions, and just on and on and on. In May, it was just a lot of fun. So it started to go away, as I say. The Holiday Inn Northwest opened up. and the profile of the driver began to change. And in the early 70s, you were coming now into the sort of the sports car type people, and less of the sprint car dirt track type people. I never saw a fight in there, but apparently there were, and Ed Elysian used to go in there, and Jimmy Bryan, and once in a while there would be a disagreement between drivers or a driver and a mechanic. On the other hand, a lot of deals were made in there. I know several drivers actually would land a ride in the White Front, talking to a mechanic or an owner, and then the White Front actually sponsored a car. I never quite understood this one. It was a dirt car that Bobby Unser drove at Sacramento 100. And now I thought, why would a bar on 16th Street in Indianapolis sponsor a dirt car that was running in Sacramento, California? But it was probably $100 or $150. Another thing, too, and I never took part in any of these, a bunch of them would go over to run Terre Haute. And this is before the freeway, so, you know, it was old National Road 40. When they came back, they would open up the White Front and go downstairs and hang out. There was a lady, after it was the Mates family, there was a lady named Audrey, and I can't remember what her surname was, but she was very, very good to the racers, and she put a lot of them on the slate, meaning that if they were down on their luck a little bit, she would just let them build up an account, and then they would finish third or fourth in a sprint race or something, and they would come in and pay her back.
Well, there you go.
Just great, great times.
Awesome.
Hey. That's a fascinating answer, and that's why I've enjoyed listening to you over the years. Thank you.
Just one final one. This just goes to show how in the mid-1950s, there wasn't a whole lot of sponsorship, and Mike Mates had racing jackets made up and gave them to the leading drivers, and there was no money, changed hands, just here's a free jacket, which said the White Front on the back. And he photographed in Vukovic Sr., Jack McGrath, and I don't remember the others, but there's photographs of Vukovic wearing his White Front jacket.
That's fantastic. Hey, Greg, thank you for the call. That means you have a phone line open, folks, 317-239-1070. If you have a question for Donald Davidson, doesn't have to be about the Brickyard 400. We're taking questions of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway and the Indianapolis 500. So we will get a break here real quick. Jerry, Tom, Mike, hang on the line. We will get to you here shortly. We'll be right back here on Talk of Gasoline Alley on 107.5 and 1070 The Fan. 107.5, 1070 The Fan. This is the Talk of Gasoline Alley. I'm David Deering. Donald Davidson, the historian of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, is right in front of me. And Donald, before we get back to the phone lines, you had something you wanted to add about Lloyd Ruby?
I did, at the White Front. And I got thinking during the break about the people that I sat with and spent time with and how they would get quite reminiscent and just share stuff with me that, you know, you would never get. And I treated all of it with great respect. So anyway, Lloyd Ruby, this had to be about 69 or 70, and Ruby had been had a contract with Ford, and he did a lot of tire testing and was well paid. I remember one time, whatever year it was, the final was at Phoenix, and he was tire testing at the Speedway because he was making just as much money testing tires as he would if he'd won the race or finished second or something. So anyway, he did a commercial. I don't know how many people might remember this, but he did a national commercial for Ford trucks, and he wore a green suit and a cowboy hat and cowboy boots, and it wasn't bad. So anyway, he was in town. It wasn't race series. This was another one of these wintertime situations. And so there was nobody else at the table, just me and Ruby. And we talked a little bit, and then the conversation just kind of wound down. And I looked at him, and he looked at me. I said, "Rube, you've done okay." And he just kind of nodded slowly, and he said, "You know," in his typical slow-talking style, he said, "When I was a teenager driving midgets in Texas and Oklahoma," he said, "I never dreamed that I could make the kind of living that I'm making now. And he had tears in his eyes. I'll never forget that because he was just looking straight at me. And what a special moment that was. Anyway, so thank you, Greg, for giving us the opportunity to talk about the wife.
I told him I'm glad he called back because we were going to continue the story on without him. So thank you for calling back, Greg. And let's get back to your phone calls, 239-1070. Jerry from Frankfort, Kentucky. Jerry, what's your question for Donald?
I have a question. First off, good evening, guys.
Good evening.
My question's about the rise of the Speedway. You know, at the time the Speedway really was built and the first races were run, you had the American Grand Prix of the Vanderbilt Cup. When did the 500 supplant those races as the biggest American race? And when did the track itself become the place to go to race or to be an American motorsport?
Well, the track was built in 1909, and the Vanderbilt Cup started in 1904, and that was using public roads on Long Island, and then it moved several times. The American Grand Prix was the first one of those was 1908, and that was in Savannah, Georgia. And then at some point, 1912, I think, then those two events would be run at the same track, just a couple of days apart, with different sanctioning bodies. And they ran Milwaukee, but not the Milwaukee Mile. They actually ran county roads in Milwaukee. They ran Santa Monica, and then they ran the San Francisco Expedition Center. But anyway, that pretty much the end of that was 1916. World War One. There was a couple of attempts to revive, but pretty much the American Grand Prix was not renewed after World War One. Indianapolis Speedway was built in 1909. As a proving ground, and they had automobile races there and motorcycles and an air display with the Wright brothers. And because of trials and tribulations that I'm just not going to dwell on a great deal here, but because of the trials and tribulations with finding the proper surface, because crushed rock and tar didn't work, and so they bought in the 3,200,000 paving bricks and ran three programs of automobile races in 1910. When it came to pass that they ran a 500 in 1911 for reasons that we've spoken about many times, I could repeat it here, but I don't want to use that too much time doing it. But when the first Indianapolis 500 was held on Memorial Day in 1911 for what was then the biggest purse ever paid. Now, you know, you'd laugh now. It was $25,000 with $10,000 going to the winner plus accessory money. But that, for the time, was massive. And because the entries, when they announced it was in September of 1910, they put out the entries very shortly thereafter. And the first entries were coming back like October the 10th and 11th of 1910, and there was a $500 entry fee, I think, which was huge for the time.
Did you say the winner got $25,000?
No, the purse was $25,000, and the winner got $10,000 plus accessory.
I entered in. There's a inflation calculator, so that ends up being about $600,000.
Okay,
but
it doesn't sound like much now,
but still.
But because they wanted just serious entries, I mean, they wanted automobile companies to enter cars. That's why they put up the hefty entry fee, which would go into the purse. But they didn't want people here on a wing and a prayer. And so anyway, they started sending the entries out early, because if it hadn't have worked, well, then they would have probably canceled the event. But the point of all this is it just took off, and the entries continued to come in January and February and March and April. And there was all kinds of publicity in the newspaper, and they just had a massive crowd on race day. So with the problems that they had 1909 and 1910, with the first 500, as I say, that, you know, in layman's language, they hit a home run the first year. The estimated crowd was 80,000, and Union Station estimated that 75,000 people came through there. There's a story from the from the time, like the next day, that said that Union Station said that this was the busiest day they'd ever had. So, so in answer to the question about at what point did the Indianapolis 500 supplant the Vanderbilt Cup and the American Grand Prize, I would say probably 1911, because and it wasn't just locals. I mean, there were train loads. As I say, Union Station, they had train loads coming in from New York, Chicago, Cleveland, St. Louis, Cincinnati, and Carl Fisher was so delighted with the outcome that he said, well, by golly, you know, we'll just double the purse for next year, which was typical Carl Fisher. So for 1912, it was a $50,000 purse with $20,000 going to the winner. And so it just seemed to, you know, it was a hit the first time and just gathered the momentum. So I think from give your the answer after probably a lengthy explanation here, or attempted explanation, by the time the break for World War One, it was probably, I mean, I would say no doubt the best known race in the United States, and on its way to becoming the best, one of the best known, if not the best known in the world, even before World War One, because the foreign participants who were courted from the very beginning started coming in 1913 and 14. And then after, in 1919, first race after the war, Europe still was still a way away from being in a position to run automobile races. The French Grand Prix was not revived until 1921. And so point being there is that a lot of Europeans came over and ran in 1919. And this is a tangent off of a tangent, but it's fascinating to me that the foreign drivers and riding mechanics who ran before and after the war that were involved in the war. And in fact, there was Robert Lallet, who was René Thomar's riding mechanic in the winning car in 1914. And they couldn't come back in 15 because they were already at the front. And when they returned in 1919, Lallet's next race back, he's riding with René Thomar, and they won the pole. In the interim, he'd been a prisoner of war.
Oh, my goodness.
So, yes, life was very different back then. But anyway, that was just a little aside I wanted to throw in. But the point is that the Europeans were coming, so it it was well on the map as being probably the best-known race in the world.
There you go,
thank
Jerry.
You very much.
Thank you, Jerry.
You're welcome.
Another phone line is open, 317-239-1070. We'll get another one in here before the break. Let's go Tom in Indianapolis. Tom, how you doing?
Hello, Donald. We've spoken several times. You were a friend of my uncle, Leonard, who was the non-destructive metals tester.
Oh, Len Wexler. Sure.
Uh-huh. Yes. How are you? I've got a question and a quick story for you.
Okay.
I'm being an early 60s muscle car guy. We were fascinated, of course, at hanging out at Uncle Leonard's booth out there, his testing booth.
And uh-huh.
Got a chance to meet Danny Ongais. And during the conversation, I was, of course, going to try to pick his brain about drag racers that were going into open wheel racing and such. And the door flies open, and in comes a mag wheel on the floor that more than likely would have crushed Ongais's foot if he'd have been a foot closer. Well, it was the number 14 car wheel, as you could maybe imagine. And behind it was A.J. Foyt, and he said to my uncle, he said, Wex, I bought a whole semi-load of these wheels, and they've all got cracks in them.
Mm-hmm.
So they put them on the Magnaflux machine, and sure enough, they found hairline. My question was, is I wanted to talk to Danny about this, but of course got interrupted. Were there other drag racers that were involved in the IndyCar racing, was Ongais the main one?
The other one was Art Pollard. I'm sorry, not Art Pollard. Art Malone. And Ongais was interesting that he was in the finals in 1966. A driver named Mike Snively won Top Fuel, and Andgaius lost. He was the final opponent in the or the losing opponent in the final. And then he comes back, and in 1978, he's on the front row for the Indianapolis 500. Anyway, Art Malone. There were other drivers that had been drag racers. Actually, Wally Dallenbach did a little drag racing. And believe it or not, A.J. Foyt took part in some drag races. There's a...
I'd be surprised if there's a form of racing A.J. hasn't done.
Well, when he would have been 20... Because I think it was 1955, there's a Hot Rod magazine with a report on the Houston Nationals or the Texas Nationals or something like that, because they had all these fancy names. And here's a photograph with two dragsters, and 20-year-old A.J. Foyt is in one. Anyway, Art Malone was from Tampa, Florida. And not only did he have a shop on the same street as Don Garlitz, they actually went to the same school. And it was when Art Malone, who I got to know quite well, when Art Malone passed away, Don Garlitz wrote about the fact that they were on the same school bus together. And a little bit later, Don Garlitz came into the museum, and I asked him about that. And he said, actually, he said, I was several years older than him, but we did ride the same bus. So he said, we knew each other as teenagers. And he said, I don't remember what he said, but he might have been like 17 and Art Malone was 14 or something like that. And so anyway, Malone came with Granatelli and drove the Novi in 63 and 64. And in fact, during the time that Granatelli had the Novis from 1961 to 1966, although it seems like it was a longer span than that, a number of those didn't qualify. The only person who took the checkered flag, it didn't go the 500 miles, but was on the track when the race was ended, the only person running at the end of a race driving a Novi was Art Malone in 1964. But anyway, then he and Garlitz actually got back together, and I'm a little bit hazy on this now. I think it was 1984, 85, and 86, and Don Garlitz hadn't run in the Nationals for a while, and then he came back, and it was really... I think would be considered a shoestring team, where he and Malone came back and Garlitz drove, and I was out there. And by that time, 1984, by that time, the big haulers were coming in now, and the motorhomes, and you had the drivers that drove only. I mean, the days of the drivers doing the mechanical work had pretty much gone by the wayside. So when a run was over, and the crew go through this awful thrash to get ready for the next round, the driver would go back and relax in an air-conditioned motorhome. Don Garlitz was out under this little trailer, like a double-axle, gooseneck thing behind a pickup truck. They'd have the trailer with an awning, and he was there with half glasses, they look over the top, actually doing his own work. And it was just, I would say, considered an upset. I mean, he was Don Garlitz, but I mean, when you looked at what they had versus what some of the other teams had, and he won it in 84, 85, and 86, I believe is correct. And I don't know if Art Malone was his partner in all three of those years, but I know at least one and maybe two. So there would be others that had done a little drag racing before they came. After they came, John Andretti.
Okay.
John Andretti ran for a while. He replaced Jack Clark in the Taco Bell car. And he did not qualify for the Nationals, but there was an event in what I'm hazy on what year this was now. But he did get to the semis. He lost... He got to the final four in at least one NHRA Top Fuel meet but not at Indianapolis. There may be a couple of others with drag racing backgrounds, but anyway, Aunt Gaius and Art Malone would be the two main. But there was a lot of crew guys that would come and be involved with the teams and drag racers hanging around. And to this day, Don Prudhomme regularly visits the Indianapolis Motor Speedway.
There you go. Hey, Tom, wow. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you, Donald. Appreciate the info.
Okay, thank you.
Another phone line open, 317-239-1070. This is the Talk of Gasoline Alley with Donald Davidson, the historian of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. We'll get another quick break here. We'll be right back in just a moment. 107.5 and 1070 The Fan. It's the Talk of Gasoline Alley on 107.5 and 1070 The Fan. I'm David Deering. Donald Davidson is here as well. And before we get back to your phone calls, I just kind of give everybody a quick heads up. Tomorrow, Kevin's mentioned it a few times, but just a reminder, tomorrow is a taped show, a Plausibly Live show. So you have already sent in your questions, and Kevin and Donald have answered those. We'll have that up tomorrow and also be on air at 8 o'clock. And then, if you call in tonight and you're not able to get through, fear not. Friday, Donald and I are back here live in studio, and we will answer your questions then, and you'll be able to call in, and we'll go from there. So, Donald, let's get back to the phone lines here. Mike from Indianapolis. Mike, you're on with Donald Davidson, man. What's your question?
Good evening, guys.
Good evening.
Yeah, Donald, when I was a little kid, my dad introduced me to Bud Tinglestad. used to tell me stories about him, and to this day we still talk about him. He was the first guy as a kid that I ever knew, and the stories about him, I was wanting to see if you could touch a little bit on him. My dad said they used to call him Bondo Bud, and he actually had his racing helmet after he had passed away, and it was the helmet that said, I believe his helmet's always said Tingy.
Yes, that's correct.
But I was wanting to know if you could highlight his career a little bit, and a little bit more about Bud, because I was infatuated with him as a kid, because I actually got to meet him.
Okay, well, you know, I'll tell you, you're not the only person that was at least fascinated by his name, because David Letterman, whenever asked about, you know, how did you get interested in the race, he said that one of the first names that he remembered was Bud Tinglestad. But Bud was a great guy. He was born in Frisee, Minnesota. I think that's right, Frisee, Minnesota. And then he fairly early on, he was living in Dayton, Ohio. And as far as Indianapolis Speedway was concerned, the span is 1960 through to 1972, and he wasn't in the race every one of those years. But in 60, he actually drove for Roy McKay of Youngstown, Ohio, and then a Jim Robbins car, a rather unique car, became available. And he qualified that, and he finished ninth as a rookie. And then in 61, he missed the show. He was in the Dean Van Lines car, and he was in a Bardol car, and did not make it. But he had a straight run from 62, 63, 64, 65, 66, 67, 68, 69. And then didn't make it in 70. Anyway, I'm kind of doing this in a complicated way. So to just go back, and I could give you all of the cars. In fact, golly, why go? Let's just do it. 62 was the Constant Hart Special. Judd Phillips, chief mechanic, Bruce Hohmeyer, the car owner. They were delayed along the way, but he completed the full 500 miles. But he was the last person on the track to go the 500. And finished 15th. In 63, he was entered with a car that had a stock block engine. It was the Auto Power Mini-O-Matic Special. Didn't make a qualifying run, but he drove the Hoover Motor Express car and was involved in an accident fairly early on. And so he hit the wall and got a 28th place finish. In 64, the Federal Engineering Detroit Special, and this was his best finish. But I think he had one better race than this, but this was his best finish, and he finished sixth. And then in 65, which I think probably was his best race, he drove the American Red Bull Special. It was a Lola, and it was owned by Lindsay Hopkins. And Foyt, there were a handful of Lolas at the track. I think maybe three, I'm going to say. Foyt had a Lotus and a Lola at his disposal. And he settled on the Lotus, and the Lola was turned over to Al Unser, who was a rookie. Parnelli had a Lotus and a Lola, and he took the Lotus in favor of the Lola, and his Lola didn't make it. And then Tingelstad, and I don't remember what other cars that might have been on the Lindsay Hopkins team, but anyway, they had a Lola, and he stuck with it, and he actually ran third for a while. And then everybody was sort of on tenterhooks because of the 1964 had been such a disastrous year. In 65, there was only one wall contact, and that was, I think it was 115 laps in Tingelstad, spun and hit the wall, but the wheel had come off. And I remember being seeing the footage later on, but actually hearing the description from Tingelstad. And somebody, after the 65 race, somebody had taken me to the Holiday Inn across the street, and I was up in somebody's room, and I never did find out whose it was, but it was Chuck Stevenson and Bob Feith and Johnny Boyd and maybe a couple of others, and Tingelstad was sitting on the bed, and somebody said, so, you know, did the wheel, you know, did you hit the wall before the wheel? He said, no, the wheel came off. He said, I'm going backwards. I hadn't hit the wall yet, and I'm looking up at the wheel. I just remember that description so well. And if you see it on film, you can't blink because it's over in a couple of seconds. But anyway, he drove for Federal Engineering again in 66, 67, and 68. In 69, he got what appeared to be the break of a lifetime. Al Unser was driving for Vels Parnelli Jones Racing in its beginning. And famously, poor Al, the first weekend of qualifying was rained out except for the Jika Saroy's run. And on the eve of the first qualifying day, when the thing had been canceled, Al had this most unfortunate accident on a motorcycle riding through the infield, and he hit a ditch and was thrown off and broke a leg, and so he couldn't run. And there was all kinds of rumors as to who they were going to bring in. I remember Jackie Stewart was mentioned as a possible replacement. George Fulmer was another. Parnelli offered it to Jim Herdebeest, but Herdebeest was so convinced that a front-engine car could still do it that he wanted to stick with the Mallard. And so Bud Tingelstad was hired by George Bignotti and Val and Parnelli to drive. And you thought, boy, this is going to be, this will put Tingelstad on Broadway. And he was running in the top 10, and then there was a mechanical failure about two-thirds of the way through the race, and so he fell out. But that looked like it was going to be the best one. Anyway, in 70, he didn't make it. And then in 71, he came back with Jerry O'Connell and the Sugar Right Prune Specials with Brabhams with modified bodies. And it was Vukovic Jr., and Tingelstad was in the second one, and Judd Phillips had the Vukovic car, and Tom Smith, who I used to spend time with in the white front, he was part owner of a sprint car. He was the chief mechanic on Tingelstad. And there's actually a little story. Have I got time to tell a story?
Yeah, we got time.
All right, then. So it ended up that Vukovic finished fifth and Bud Tingelstad finished seventh, and that was his last start. He was with the Walther family in 72, but when Salt had a problem with his primary car and he needed another car. Tingelstad turned his car over to Salt Walther, and Walther went out and qualified it. But anyway, I guess it's okay to tell this story. The Sugar Right Prune cars were owned by Jerry O'Connell, And Jerry O'Connell was from San Jose, and his family was in the fruit packing business. And I remember that when I was working at USAC, and I kept the records and had to do the 1099 forms and everything, more and more teams were forming corporations. Not only the Indianapolis owners, but also Sprint and Midget people were starting to do that. And I think that the rule was I had to turn in a 1099 for anybody that made more than $300, and I think eventually it became $600, if they were an individual. If they were a corporation, I didn't have to turn anything at all. And it got to the point where Lindsay Hopkins and Jerry O'Connell were the only championship owners that were still doing that way. And I remember going to Jerry O'Connell one time, and I said, look, you know, you've got two cars. They make a lot of money, thousands and thousands of dollars, and I will have to turn in a 1099 for you. If you form a corporation, I won't have to do it at all. And he said, no, I want to keep doing it that way. So anyway, a few years went by. I'm in the garage area when the Talker Gasoline Alley used to be from 6 to 7, and it was in the garage area. And I was already working at the track by this time, so I went over from the museum a little earlier than normal, and I come in the Pennzoil Gate, or what is now the Pennzoil Gate, and there was a bunch of people standing around and all just telling stories. And so I got involved in that a little bit. And then gradually it broke up. And there was this one fellow I kept looking at, and I thought, I know him, but I can't place him. And so everybody was gone. And I said, excuse me, sir. I said, I know you, but I can't place you. And he said, Jerry O'Connell. I said, oh, my goodness me. I said, I haven't seen you for years. So we talked a little bit. I said, can I run by a story about you that I was told? And I said, this is such a neat story. I don't want to find out it isn't true. But they said, okay, what? And he was just a really nice guy. I said, well, there was a rumor that when you had midgets and Hank Butcher drove for you and so on and so forth, and then when you got into championship racing, you had a bet. Your mother bet you $1 million that you couldn't get a car in the top 10 in the Indianapolis 500. And you collected by getting a fifth and a seventh with Vukovich and Tinglestad and collected the million. And he said, that is a true story.
Huh.
So there you are. I don't know if that one's been on Wikipedia, but it's a true story.
Great stuff.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Mike.
Just to wind up, Tinglestad was somebody I got to know really well. I really liked him. And unfortunately, he came to a rather sad end with his deteriorating health, but he was a great guy, and he had a wonderful period in 1964. He was driving Wally Moskowski's sprint car, and it seems to me that he won, I don't remember the order, but he won a feature at Winchester and a feature at Salem, and I think they were like 2 weeks apart. I don't know, but anyway, Tinglestad was a great sprint car driver. He won the championship race at DuQuoin in 1966, and the party went on for several days. He was a great guy. I was very fond of him.
Awesome. Mike, thank you so much again. We're going to get a quick break here, our final break, actually. We'll be right back with the Talk of Gasoline Alley on 107.5 and 1070 The Fan. This is the Talk of Gasoline Alley, 107.5, 1070 The Fan. I'm David Deering. Donald Davidson is right over there. We are in our final segment of the evening. We got full phone lines. We'll try to get to as many as possible, but if we don't get to you tonight, fear not. We're back live Friday from 8 to 9. Tomorrow's a tape show with Kevin and Donald, but Friday, answering your questions. So let's get right to it here. Mark from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Mark, you are on with Donald Davidson.
Hello, Mark. That's not Mark Wilkie, is it?
No. Okay. Not Mark Wilkie, no.
Okay.
The question I had for you, Donald, is just recently I came into a bunch of memorabilia from Champion Spark Plug in the Indianapolis 500.
Uh-huh.
And you've talked a lot about, you know, Freddie Agubation and Jerry Grant and that relationship. But one guy that's part of this that I don't think you've ever talked about is Lee Petty. And I don't know, does he have a connection to the track or to the to the champion company, or how does he get involved with this?
With Lee Petty?
Lee Petty. I believe. I don't know. Maybe a lot of it's back when it could be just part of when he won because he won the very first down in Daytona. He won the very first Daytona 500. And
sure.
A lot of the 40s and 50s is where all this stuff is from.
But okay.
He's in there, and I didn't know if he was part of this safety program that Champion Spark Plug used to run or not, but I just wondered, being it was Brickyard 400 week, I thought I'd ask you about him.
Okay, no, that's fine. No connection that I know of. The highway safety program drivers were all for a while they were all members of the Champion 100 Mile an Hour Club. And they relaxed that a little bit later on, and I could run through the drivers, but no, Lee Petty, he may have run champions, but he had no.
I remember that him and Richard were always champion spark plug drivers. They had it like on their car and stuff. But I knew it was in the family, or not in the family, but they sponsored the family for the longest time.
Well, the only connection is I know that he visited the track once. There's a great photograph, and I think it's 1965, I think, and it's in the garage area, and it's Foyt and Lee Petty and Richard Petty, a very young Richard Petty, and that would be about the only connection that I know of. But I would be interested to know what you have. And one of my colleagues who I know will be listening will be exceptionally interested to know what you've got in the way of champion spark plug memorabilia. Because
I didn't want to get into it. It's kind of a long story. My roommate in college, his father was vice president of the aeronautics division of Champion Spark Plug. And they did a bunch of things. And there's, I don't know. I got a bunch of knickknacks, ashtrays, and postcards, and it's just a couple of great big piles of stuff. His he died a while ago, but his wife just died, so he knew that I was really into the 500, and he didn't want all the stuff, so he sent it all to me. So I was going through it. I got a hold of it the other day, and I just thought I'd call you and ask about Rich Petty. Yeah.
All right. Well, I'll tell you what. We want to try and get a couple more callers
in.
If you would call me seriously about this, if you would call me at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway tomorrow, Friday's going to be a little busy. So if you can't do it tomorrow, maybe next week, I'd be very interested in talking with you. So just call the switchboard, ask for me, and a colleague of mine will be very interested in what you have. So thanks for calling.
Thank you, Mark.
Okay.
Well, let's get right back on here. Jonathan from Chicago, Illinois. Jonathan, you're on with Donald Davidson.
Hi, Jonathan.
Evening, gentlemen. I was wondering if you could do a profile on Chicago's umbrella Mike Boyle.
Sure. Unfortunately, because of Mike Boyle's business dealings, and he was the business manager for whatever the number of the union was in that area. But anyway, he was a very powerful man. Unfortunately, he was the guest of the government a couple of times, and so some people sort of discredit him for those activities. There's all kinds of different versions. There was a book written about him, supposedly, that was not very flattering, and I think a lot of it wasn't exactly true. But if you take that away, in my mind, if you can take that, separate that, and just do what did he do at the track, he was by far the preeminent car owner in the 1930s. 1926, he entered cars from 1926 through 1946, and of course 42 through 45 there was no race, but he won three times. He won with Bill Cummings in 34, and then Wilbur Shaw with the Maserati in 39 and 40. But he would run three and four cars at a time when most people would only have one and occasionally two. So Billy Arnold drove for him in 28 and 29. Cliff Woodbury was third in 26. This won't be all of them, but have to scamper along here a little bit. Lou Moore was on the pole for Mike Boyle in 32. Bill Cummings was on the pole in 33 and then won it in 34. Babe Stapp led the race in 33 for Boyle. Louis Meyer, Chet Miller, Ted Horn all had top finishes. And in fact, Louis Meyer actually owned his own car and let Ralph Hepburn drive it in 1937 because he had a better deal to be paid by Mike Ball to drive for him. So, and as successful as he was in the race, in qualifications, it was amazing. And I forget what the stats are now. The number of cars that he had start on either the first or second row. And it's just a shame that because of his business activities and run-ins with the law, that actually when he passed away, the Chicago Tribune almost didn't want to exist that he had ever lived. But and some people say he was a great man. Other people say he wasn't. But again, separate all of that and look what he did. There was no question that he had by far the finest race team for all the way through the 1930s until right after the war.
Did I see that they were trying to rehab his old shop over by the old Busch Stadium?
Yes, that was pretty unusual for there to be a race shop. There was actually, they kept the cars downtown in another building, and sometime around 33 or so, 1701 Ghent, or however that's pronounced, was a building where the Boyle Racing headquarters were. All the way through until, I don't know if they stayed there after the war or not, 46 maybe. But anyway, yes, that building, there's a move on to try and save it. I mean, it's a lot of work because it was really kind of far gone. But I think they're sort of dismantling and saving what they can and refurbishing the bricks and building it up. It's quite a task, but a lot of famous race cars came out of there. So we thank you very much for calling.
Yes, thank you, Jonathan.
Thank you.
All right, so we'll end the show here with that.
Okay.
Thank you, everybody, for calling. We had fantastic calls tonight. Phone lines were off the hook. David, Carrie, I see you guys still on there. Sorry we didn't get to you, but we are live Friday. Tomorrow's show is already in the can. It's plausibly live, as Kevin likes to say. So tomorrow's show will be an email show. But Friday, Donald and I are back here in studio, 8 o'clock to 9, 317-239-1070. Call a little beforehand so I can get you on and make sure we're good to go. And we'll answer your questions. Doesn't have to be NASCAR. Donald is here. We'll answer Indianapolis Motor Speedway questions, Indy 500 questions, really whatever you guys want to ask. We'll do our best.
So, I bet George Conner drove Boyle cars as well. still clicking away here.
Donald, thank you so much.
Thank you, David. It was a lot of fun. Everybody.
Absolutely. We'll have the podcast up, 1070thefan.com, and check it out on iTunes as well. Have a good night, everybody.